think of a sneaker much like an asset class, right? Or a stock and a share. So that the price of that shoe, of course, fluctuates on a daily basis. And every single size, you know, almost every single size in every single shoe has a different price to it.
Welcome to the Interline Podcast. In this episode, we're going to be talking about the secondary market, which is a catch-all term you can slice a lot of different ways. It's about circularity, giving products the longest possible lifespan through pre-love programs and platforms. It's about scarcity, speculation, resale. It's about building channels and relationships that transcend the initial transaction. It's about minimizing fashion's spiraling impact on the environment. The way I choose to look at the secondary market is as a microcosm for a lot of what fashion tries to do with new product, just with the complexities of design, sourcing, and manufacturing stripped out. And when you step aside from those considerations, you're left with some essential priorities: intelligent demand sensing and pricing, product authentication and brand identity, provable sustainability, and the big ticket question of what fashion might look like when brands are forced to simply make less stuff. To debate some of those points and more, I'm joined for this episode by Moses Rashid. He's the CEO of The Edit London, which is billed as being a global online destination for limited sneakers and high-end streetwear. Now, before we get to mine and Moses's conversation, which is tech-centric in some ways that might just surprise you, I'd like to talk for a moment about our sponsor for this show. Now, before products make it to the secondary market, there's just as much innovation and technology-driven transformation taking place in the processes of creating new products, in sourcing, manufacturing, and across the entire extended product lifecycle. So much innovation, in fact, that it can be tricky to keep track of, whether you're new to fashion technology as a whole, or whether you're working on diving deeper into a particular area like sustainability or digital product creation. The fashion industry moves fast, and fashion technology moves even faster. That's why the Interline is partnering again with Sourcing at Magic, the leading North American and international destination event, to bring the full spectrum of fashion technology to life across education sessions, live discussions, exhibitors and demonstrations, all in a dedicated fashion technology community, live in Las Vegas from 7th to 9th of August 2023. As well as bringing together brands, retailers, manufacturers, suppliers, and service providers to conduct the core business of fashion and connect the industry's value chain, Sourcing at Magic in August 2023 will be home to three educational communities: fashion entrepreneurship, sustainability and social good, and fashion technology, with the Interline proud to be the on-site partner for the latter. Registration for that August event in Las Vegas will open soon, and I hope I'll see you there. In the meantime, you can find out more at www.sourcingatmagic.com or by reading the Interline's collaboration with Sourcing at Magic, who sponsored this episode, titled Future-Proofing Fashion Through Technology, which you can find by searching on the Interline. Now, back to my conversation with Moses. Moses, welcome to the show. I'd like to start. Give us an idea of where your idea for the Edit London came from and how it's scaled as quickly as it has. What's it been like running the business for the last year or so?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really interesting ride. You know, for me, I've kind of built and sold a few businesses in very different industries. But, you know, I guess the idea, you know, I was at a sneaker festival purchasing some sneakers for about kind of £600-700. Asked a very simple question: do you have a plastic bag for me? And the response I got back was no, and it just blew my mind. I was paying a premium but not getting a premium service. So as I kind of walked away that day, I just thought to myself, look, you know, what actually exists in market? And I looked at other marketplaces, and of course, you know, to call out, there's the like of StockX and Goat, which are kind of global behemoths. But what I didn't see anywhere was premium. And again, what did that mean? It was really about product curation. It was about speed of and then obviously lumped in with a kind of a healthy portion of service. And so that I guess is where the Edit London came from. And then as we've continued to grow at a rate of about 500-600%, you know, year on year, you know, we've really doubled down into those kind of three core pillars to really get focused on our target audience, really understand what they need, what they want, you know, and obviously kind of technology, our evolving tech's kind of been at the core of that in terms of how we've really kind of been able to build our value proposition.
Awesome. Let's just walk back a little bit then. Let's just talk about how the business operates. More specifically, what the where you fit into the relationship between sellers and buyers as a marketplace, what your roles and responsibilities are as an intermediary, and you know how you go about adding that premium layer, how you go about doing the other bits to fit with it, and tell us a little bit as well about some of the department store partnerships that you now have, the NBA partnership that you now have, because those are different things from the kind of global behemoths you were just talking about.
Yeah, so I guess maybe if I take a step back, and just for those that maybe aren't aware of the Edit London, and you know, hopefully you are, we're the most premium sneaker, streetwear, collectibles marketplace globally. Now, about 70% of our revenue came from e-com, but actually, as you've mentioned there, Ben, you know, we've got a huge we've got a piece of our business which I guess sits within concession stores and then private shopping. So those concessions being, you know, the likes of Harrods in London, Galeries Lafayette in Doha, Harvey Nichols in Riyadh, and soon to be in Amsterdam also. Now, I guess one, if we go back to the earlier question, I kind of talked about product curation. So, you know, what's our relationship between, you know, the buyers and the sellers? Now, part one is, of course, we connect the two, but we want to make sure that our buyers get the coolest and the hottest product at the right price. And so part one is about really being able to harness the top level of reseller, if you like. And when I talk about that, I mean, you know, we don't necessarily focus on the people who have, say, one or two products to sell. Really, relationships tend to sit with the people that have got, say, 50 or 100 units to sell or more, and actually operate like small businesses, get access to product, early product, before others. So for example, right now, what's super hot at the moment is the Tiffany Air Force One. They actually released, I believe it's the first or the second week of March, you know, and actually we've been selling in-hand pairs. So normally what happens when a sneaker drops, there's early release pairs that are out in market. We've actually managed to get a hand on a whole bunch of them. I think we sold about 10 or 15 of them just last week, to give you an idea. And of course, our customers have got them in hand already. So again, what's that relationship is about? Making sure we can provide access. So, you know, make the inaccessible accessible, if you like, in the slickest, smoothest way possible through our platform, of course. And of course, with every single item, there needs to be authentication that happens in the middle. So, of course, once that sale goes through, that item comes to Edit London HQ, and then, of course, is checked through, you know, through our robust authentication process, which includes, you know, there's an element of manual through to, you know, the AI tech that we use to kind of ensure that every product is the right product using various data points. And I know, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about that. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, ensuring that the customer is communicated to, then obviously we get that, you know, get that to them. I mean, NBA partnerships. I think you're referring to the Chicago Bulls there, right? So
I am. Yep.
So that was, yeah, that was, you know, that was something, you know, about 5 months ago, I kind of thought to myself, look, if we're really going to take on the US, you know, consider it a statement of intent. How are we going to really break open the market, make people kind of stand up and take a look at what we're doing, you know, from in a, what I guess what you can consider a pretty competitive marketplace. So mm-hmm. Yeah, we approached Chicago, you know, we start having, you know, some really interesting chats. And now think of that from having in-stadium media, having official designation on a global level, you know, through to, we've got an asset, for example, which is kind of the walk-in series, which is really, really cool. So in the US, it's all about, you know, what these ballers are wearing. And so, you know, we've done a huge piece around that. And of course, we are the presenting partner for the Chicago Bulls game against the Detroit Pistons in Paris for London Fashion Week. For Paris Fashion Week.
And you touched a little bit on the overall kind of limited edition drop model, and you talked about kind of early access pairs, things along those lines. Let's walk back a tiny bit further for anyone who's not familiar with just how the sneaker kind of aftermarket works, if you like, and how pricing operates and how that cycle works, because I think everyone's aware largely of the whole sneakerhead hype culture that exists. Everyone's aware that limited editions and collaborations are a major deal. I don't think everybody necessarily realizes just how mature a market this has become, because you, like you said, you're not just talking about individual resellers. You're talking about actors who operate like a small business. You're talking about a very comprehensive, very mature, very well-rounded secondary market here, right?
Exactly that, yeah.
So I'd like to ask your question as well. Do you look at The Edit London as being a tech company, a fashion company, or a bit of a hybrid of the two? Because when you take a step back and think about it, you got an app, you have a platform, you have an SDK, you have algorithms. All of those are the kind of things you would associate more with a technology company than a retailer, or necessarily with a marketplace. What's your take on that? How do you define yourself?
Really simply, I mean, we're a tech business. It's just the currency that flows through the tech is sneakers, streetwear, and collectibles. You know, that idea of us being a fashion company, I mean, you could call us a fashion brand, if you like, by way of some of the, you know, the PR that you'll see. But ultimately, we're a technology business. And, you know, everything, all the tech that we've kind of enabled here is, you know, built proprietary since the beginning. And again, we'll continue to do so.
Okay, perfect. So let's talk a little bit more about the tech then. And I want to start with something that you and I mentioned prior to this conversation, which was the automated market tracking. So I believe you have a proprietary solution that scrapes a bunch of data points around pricing. That then confers some benefits onto sellers. It gives them some new insights. And it confers some benefits onto you at The Edit London because it enables you to do automatic calculation of your margin. And that's sort of emblematic of a much broader trend towards pricing intelligence and market intelligence that exists across the whole footwear industry, across the apparel industry as well. So tell me why you went about doing it that way and tell me how you did it.
Yeah, I think, you know, so I think your previous question when you talked about aftermarket, you know, pricing, think of a sneaker much like an asset class, right? Or a stock and a share. So that the price of that shoe, of course, fluctuates on a daily basis. And every single size, you know, almost every single size in every single shoe has a different price to it, i.e. UK 4 will be a different price to UK 8, for example. So that, of course, becomes there's market volatility based on, of course, supply and demand of said pair or indeed said size. So for us, part one was about just trying to understand how we're going to be able to control that, because actually what that meant as a business was, you know, on some days the cost of product was much higher, you know, than we thought it was just yesterday. So firstly, that was, I guess, kind of delivered the importance. Part two was, you know, we kind of built this tool which simply looked at, you know, it looked at all competitor platforms and it pulled all of this data, you know, from across the net to look at kind of the trends, for example, the market volatility, what we saw as being what we could assess by way of a trend. You know, can we actually see this product selling further by way of kind of the volume of sales? And actually our tech can determine whether or not actually we should start investing more money into that product ourselves, because we've got a portion of our business which is, you know, purchases what we refer to as owned by stock, whether or not we should start selling. So again, very much, very similar to, you know, what you'd see when people are buying stocks and shares in the city, I guess, you know, but effectively applied that to the sneaker world.
Yeah, no, that's really great insight. And I think, you know, being able to have that level of agility and that level of insight into what your raw costs are, what your margins are, that's something that, again, is emblematic of the broader kind of footwear and apparel industry, where everybody's margin, whether you're making product or reselling or buying finished product, your margin's eroding because your costs are constantly fluctuating, especially at the moment. And that level of intelligence, that level of insight and visibility is something that I suspect everybody listening to this wishes they could build for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's really interesting is, again, we talk about that, the supply side of our business, so the reseller side, and actually we've got account managers in-house that effectively analyze the data that, of course, we've just talked about. And then we'll pull that data, push that out to our reseller set, and particularly what we refer to as our baller sellers, who are our top tier of sellers, and say, hey, these are the trends we're seeing. Our suggestion that you should go out and buy and acquire and procure these pairs, and then you should put them on our platform at this price. And if you do that, then actually the suggested profit on said products would be X, for example. So actually our guys are proactively working with our reseller set to support them in, you know, shifting more stock, providing them with better data to make more product, but also saying, hey, look, we're gonna support you in kind of building your business as well.
That's really interesting, because I've been providing that level of visibility to everybody who has a stake in and everybody who uses the platform, is it's a net benefit for basically every stakeholder there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, ultimately for the customer, and this is all about, you know, what benefits the customer, and who you know, can we get the coolest kicks to that customer as quickly as possible? You know, we want to make sure they've got, you know, options. We want to make sure it's delivered to them at the right price, at the right speed, from the right people. You know, so the more transparent and the more proactive we can be with sharing information such as that out to market, then actually, again, it only just kind of supports and accelerates the Edit London's growth.
Staying on the tech topic then, you know, you touched on it before, which is authentication and inspection, and your use of AI there. So you and I had a conversation before, and we talked about how you're using artificial intelligence to capture data points to allow you to verify the authenticity of product when it comes in. Tell us a little bit about how that works. That's something you built in-house as well, as I understand it. So tell us a bit about how that works, what the process looks like, and how that gives you total confidence that the products that go through the Edit London's marketplace are what they say they are.
Yeah, so effectively we've built a layer of this tech and this AI that is now kind of sits within our SDK, if you like, which effectively as a product arrives here at Edit London HQ, it goes through various steps. So there's an element of manual, and then also you've got the you know, you've got the AI, the automated piece. So part one is obviously, of course, the authentication manager will kind of run that product through various tests, which, you know, from a manual level will look like touch, feel, smell, and again, obviously looking the product over. At that point, it will then be captured via photo and essentially placed in, think of it like a light box, or like a similar to MRI scanner, if you like, where effectively the product will get scanned from top to bottom, left to right. And essentially we'll look at pulling lots and lots and lots of data that's being built into the SDK historically, and effectively see if it can find any discrepancies in that product. And again, we use this to essentially support the decision of passing a product, or actually support the decision of saying, no, this product, actually there's discrepancy with it, and actually we're going to fail the item, let's say. And so we run it through this kind of vigorous test. Every single product at that point then gets white carded. So then we support the database, and all of that information similarly gets absorbed into the SDK for the next sneaker that comes through. And then of course at that point it's either passed or it's not. Of course, when it's passed, it's, you know, wrapped up and it's nice packaging and then sent out to customer that day. And that process works really interesting, and it probably sounds like it's quite laborious, but depending on the shoe, it can be anything from, say, 1 to 3 minutes, or say 1 to 5 minutes. Very rarely does it need to be, you know, any longer than that.
Which is interesting, because when you're dealing with the volume of product that I assume you are, you wouldn't want to have a fully manual bottleneck on that kind of throughput. So you're using tech in an interesting way, in the sense that it's allowing you to do something at scale that you wouldn't otherwise be able to scale that way.
Exactly. Yeah. And effectively every single product goes through the exact same check, right? So for example, when we're putting it through and positioning a shoe within that kind of MRI scanner, we're white carding the product, you know, there are certain positions that the tech effectively will suggest for us to kind of capture the you know, the images, and then it will start doing its magic from there, if you like. So yeah, it's a really interesting piece of kit that absolutely supports our growth and scale, and of course on the global level. So and of course, if there's anything that flags, then straight away that's kind of pushed out to the wider team, and then you've got more hands that get on it, and then it goes through the same checks again. And at that point, if it's, you know, it's flagged, then essentially that product's discarded and sent back to the seller, and then the team will then procure a new product.
Yeah, that makes sense. One other question I had on the on that side of things. When you identify discrepancies, so you're identifying a discrepancy between the product your team has on hand and what's the frame of reference for discrepancies? Where do you get the original kind of product data that allows you to say this is or is not an example of X sneaker?
Yeah, so again, you're looking at a wealth of knowledge that gets kind of inputted into a database from product specialists that include, of course, those at the Edit London, but those at, you know, other reputable platforms and so forth. You know, that gets all pulled into one place. And when I say discrepancy, that discrepancy could be a number of things, right? So I guess the one part of, you know, this piece of tech uses everything from like scanning to UV lights and all these kind of, you know, bits of wizardry. But when I say discrepancy, it could highlight, for example, a scuff on the shoe. It could highlight something, glue on the lace. You know, it could be as small as that. Or actually, it could tell you, hold up, actually, the type of glue that's been used isn't consistent with what we'd typically see in, say, a Jordan 1. And actually, that then might flag up as and then you could run it through, you know, another test just to actually see if that, you know, again, is a genuine product or not.
That's a great point, because you're it's not necessarily the broad pieces. It's some of the finer construction details and things like that would clue you into the fact that something is not a match.
Exactly. And, you know, this is all under the guise of, you know, again, us being the most premium within our space, need to make sure that when we're sending the product to the end user, that actually, you know, we're sending the perfect product. And actually, what's really interesting, if I just kind of highlight one of the biggest items that we see queries with, let's call it QA issues with, is the Dunk Low Panda. So you'd have seen probably on the streets of London, hundreds of people wearing these black and white Nike Dunks. And the GS pairs, which is typically what you refer to as grade school or youth sizing, is typically the one that, you know, people will turn around and say, hey, is this a genuine product? Or the quality of the shoe isn't perfect, the, you know, stitching slightly off. Actually, it's just because that, you know, actually a lot of the QC in what you refer to as some of that cheaper product, mainly because it's just mass produced, just simply isn't great quality. And so it takes for our team to understand that, you know, to whether or not to actually pass that product or not.
That's really interesting. The one other piece of tech I just want to touch on would be, you've talked a bit about it already, which is being the premium player in this space. Yeah. And that's replicating the kind of brand retail experience and building those sort of customer relationships, which I would look at from a tech point of view as being, if I'm a buyer and I want to purchase something through the Edit London, there's an experience I want to have there. I want the same way of engaging with you that I would have with a brand. I want to be able to check how my order is progressing. I want to rely on customer service. You know, there's a whole kind of paradigm of interaction there that is, it's different from the hands-off way that I think people might expect that a marketplace operates. It's about curating that relationship. Tell me how you go about that and how the sort of the platform and the tech allows you to build those relationships.
Yeah, I think, you know, from an automated point of view, you'll get, you know, updates daily or bi-daily on your product journey. So that's part one. Part two, if you talk about like the user experience point of view, so on a mass scale, you know, our response time within emails, for example, is 30 minutes. Chatbot, of course, is instant. And then via social platforms, typically within 1 minute to 3 minutes. So then we're really honing in on the customer experience. And then if we take another step back, we became the first global sneaker platform to actually launch a same-day service. Now, to give you clarity, that is in a market which typically would take 2 to 5 weeks to receive your product. So you put a huge emphasis on how can we get quicker? How can we make it smoother and slicker? It's really, and actually a lot of that, if I take you back to the beginning, a lot of that came down to that day where I thought, blimey, you know, if I'm going to pay premium for this product. I'm not going to get a premium service, but now I need to wait for, you know, 3 weeks or 5 weeks for my shiny to turn up. It just simply didn't make sense. And so, you know, a lot of this business we born out of personal need, I guess. My own kicks quicker than everybody else, but that, you know, that's what it was. So we really, really honed in on a couple of things there, which was, you know, we're in an experience economy. So what does that mean? If you think of like the modern affluent, they're not, it's not necessarily about the price, it's about the experience. Hey, if I've got, you know, if I've got a birthday to go to on the weekend, I just want to find out if my product is actually going to turn up. And actually just having that relationship with somebody in the business, you know, naturally our customer services manager, Joseph, who's brilliant, you know, we'll always kind of drop somebody a call after they've received the product. Is everything good? Yes, it is. Hey, you know, here's my email. If you need anything, just reach out. Oh, yeah. And if you do, let me get my personal shopping team to support you on that, you know, and then they could receive a WhatsApp from a personal shopper here. And suddenly they've got that direct dial.
And that, you know, you are honing in very much on the service side of things there, which is something that a lot of brands and a lot of retailers are recognizing can be their secret sauce, that can be their differentiator as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you touched on it before, you asked that question, like, are we a tech business or are we a fashion brand? And actually, you know, a marketplace by nature, of course, is a transactional platform, right? But actually, by way of the brand, you know, I answered the second part of that. I said, you know, there's elements of what you could call a fashion brand, but actually what we do as a business is really focusing on culture and community. And I guess they're the brand-led elements of why people become intrinsically bought into what we're doing. And actually, the Chicago Bulls is a great piece of that, because actually we thought about, you know, where do we want to see the Edit London? Who do we want to see us partnered with? And when you think of sneakers, naturally you think of Michael Jordan. So it felt like the right thing to kind of go to the home of, you know, Michael Jordan being the Chicago Bulls. So it's elements of that, and really about how we think about our brand beyond just being a transactional platform, because that is actually not what we are. We're an experience built, you know, business, which is, you know, really catering to the customer need and making things incredibly accessible, you know, and in your hands as quickly as possible.
That's perfect. I'm going to shift gears a little bit, and I just want to ask you about how you see the importance of marketplaces, both aftermarket and kind of what you might refer to as secondary, circular, pre-loved, that kind of thing. The role of those in reducing the footwear and apparel industry's outsized environmental footprint. Because I know your website prominently displays the amount of plastic, like virgin plastic, saved by resale. Give me your thoughts on what you see as your role there and the broader role of the ongoing secondary market and the circularity in helping to blunt some of fashion's impact on the environment.
I think, you know, what's really interesting is that, you know, we really tackled sustainability in three ways. And, you know, we really thought about it, like, how can we deliver? So part one is that we've got this huge brand that we know we've got eyes on. So firstly, we need to make sure we're doing our piece. So part one, as you said, we've got a ticker on our site. I think we've already collected nearly 500,000 kilos of plastic out of the oceans. You know, and that's actually every sale that goes to our platform, we collect 1 kilo of plastic. So part two, of course, was to build our own pre-loved marketplace to really drive that circular economy. So part, you know, so we educate from the point of sale, and actually in the product's life cycle, you know, you can, you'll be able, if you look after the shoe, you'll be able to retain its value, at least to a certain point. So let's call that 50% or even 100% of the value of that product. And then you'll be able to sell it back through the edit prelove.com. So just for clarity, we actually built that pre-loved marketplace about a year ahead of our original forecast, because actually we see that as a huge opportunity, but, you know, really something where we can kind of fuel this product. And our product is principally luxury, I guess, you know, with a price point of about 360 to 400 quid back through the market. The next piece in terms of like how we deliver that to market was we want to drive, you know, a fully circular business. Now we're about what we call 80% wastage, which actually means we've actually bought a whole load of tech and machinery where, as an example, You know, when cardboard boxes come in, we put that through this machine, which effectively turns it into bubble wrap, effectively, which we then put into our recycled boxes and then send back out, you know, to the end user. So I think, you know, it's incredibly important that more and more brands are becoming more sustainably aware. I guess the question is, what is sustainable? I think our role in that, I think, you know, you're seeing consumer behaviors changing from buying fast fashion, you know, and actually purchasing luxury items or those items that hold its value, and actually knowing that, then there'll be a longer life cycle on said product. The next part of that is to make sure that, you know, people know where they can sell that product authentically. You know, and actually, look, you've seen pre-loved sites like Vestiaire, you know, for example, which is a great example. Depop, Vinted, you know, all of these guys, you know, who are doing really well. And I guess our pre-loved site is curated perfectly for this respective market. And so when I say that, it's about creating the right types of brands. And then educating that, you know, if somebody buys from us, you know, from day one, that actually will be there to support your next sale. And actually, of course, if you sell through the Edit Pre-Loved, we give you a £10 credit to spend back on the editlondon.com.
Interesting. That's good model for stickiness. And I think overall, you know, you hinted at it there. Scarcity is kind of a prescient model in some senses, because there's a lot of brands. You mentioned fast fashion, prime culprit, not the only culprit. There's a lot of brands that overproduce, right? Fashion as an industry makes too much product, and that kind of model of making a lot of stuff and selling it in high volumes, low cost, it feels like there's a shelf life on that, and I think a lot of brands are realizing that they're going to need to make more limited quantities in the future. And in that sense, this whole segment is potentially ahead of the curve in the way that it operates.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's really interesting, and again, if you go back to my earlier point, which is talking about sneakers as an asset class, over time, the product will typically appreciate in value. And I'll give you an example. Like I purchased a Jordan 1 High Trophy Room. So there's only 12,000 of these sneakers made. And I purchased it for £1,700. I wore it for about a year. Obviously, wore it very lightly, you know, in that period. But I then sold it 12 months later. Now, in that 12-month period, the new price of that, the new market price, had actually inflated from £1,700 to £3,000 for that particular shoe in that size. So after wearing that product for 12 months, I sold that shoe for over £2,000. I think it was £2,100. So I actually made £400 on that product, and I've got my 12 months wear out of it. I mean, that, you know, so when you think of it like that, and then you think about how we're then fueling, you know, you know, when I talk about investing in the right type of product and investing in, say, luxury fashion versus, say, fast fashion, I mean, it's really clear to me, you know, where the value sits there.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, that for a lot of people, that's a prohibitive price point to begin with, but not when you reframe it from the perspective of it, like you said, it's something that appreciates over time. Then it starts to become easier to get that consumer behavioral change and that brand behavioral change to make less, to buy with a longer term horizon.
Yeah.
Perfect. Last question would be, what's your take on digital collectibles, digital scarcity? So, you know, we know one of the biggest footwear brands in the world has its own digital collectibles marketplace now, its own channel. And I think a lot of other brands in footwear and apparel are looking at that model and wondering how that's going to shape out, because it's not just a case of having 3D representations of a garment or a sneaker and selling those. It's a question of, what does that look like from a scarcity perspective, from limited editions, for collectability, for resale, for royalties? There's a lot of direct parallels and analogs between the physical sneaker model and the digital collectibles model. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on it.
I find it a fascinating space. Actually, we entered that ourselves. You know, we're kind of testing and measuring. We entered the metaverse via Blocktopia, and we're working on a full kind of proposition around this. But I think, okay, so if we look at something like Nike and Artifact, I think what they did really well was you know, they actually attached both the digital and then the physical product to it. So they released 10 sneakers. I think they were between 2,000 and 10,000 units of each shoe. You could then actually forge that product after a 12-month period to receive the real life item. And actually, it's at that point where the item is so rare, of course, that holds, you know, real value. So I think that approach is really interesting. I think for kind of the wider community and you know, people that might be thinking about, like, is this somewhere to invest? You know, I guess really that'll be down for you to determine. But I kind of think of it like this. So, you know, I'm what, 38 now. So I remember, you know, when I was a child, you know, you'd go to school and you'd use a pen and a pencil, right, and a notepad. You know, whereas for the youth today, actually, they're growing up with iPhones, iPads, and so forth. So they're early adopters of technology. Okay, I'm going to frame it slightly differently. So if you think about brands, so, you know, Ben, I'm not sure what your fashion styles are, but, you know, when I was 16, we'd go to someone like Top Man to go and purchase a T-shirt. Yeah. And then we turned 21 and we all started going to All Saints. And then
you and me both on both of those counts.
That's it, exactly. And then we 25, we started investing in brands. I find this really interesting, but actually that trend is now happening from as early as about 12 or 13 years old. So now some of these teenagers are now, you know, purchasing designer brands, which hold a bit of value. So let's, in this case, call them sneakers, that then send them on for a profit, making, I don't know, 20, 30, 40, 50 pounds. Now they're getting to an age where they go, okay, well, where, for example, we were a little bit younger, we might have had, let me think, Tamagotchis back in the 90s, I think it was, or the noughties, where we had these little computerized pets was the kind of thing, right? But, you know, actually their version of that is an NFT or digital collectible, which they're now investing in. So now they're playing around with that, you know, winning on some, losing on some others, but ultimately building a bit of a stockpile of money. And then suddenly, you know, you hear these stories of how quite young guys and girls have, you know, made quite a bit of money in, you know, crypto or whatever it might be, or digital art. And that, for me, when I kind of really broke it down and thought about it, I thought, wow, okay, this is really interesting. And actually, as a result, it was kind of as we really started breaking down and strategizing, we became the first, you know, global sneaker platform to actually start accepting crypto, even though the crypto market's on the floor for a lot. You know, we found it really interesting to say, hey, well, actually, yeah, you can deploy your money here. So, you know, to your point, you know, I think, as with anything, that requires mass market adoption. I don't think we're there yet. It's still a very niche subsection of, you know, the community that, of course, has. But I think inevitably over time, I think we'll get there.
Is there anything else that we've not touched on in terms of your thoughts on the intersection of technology and sneakers, the intersection of technology and fashion in general?
I think I think what you're going to see is, and actually, I think it was just this morning, I saw a really interesting article around AI being the future of sneaker designers. And so I think what we're going to see, and again, if you break down technology, again, we can talk about tech platforms or the tech that's used to create certain items, like the Nike Space Hippie, which uses, I think they refer to it as space trash, for example, where it's 100% recyclable. You know, I think we're going to continue to see lots and lots of innovation. You know, I think fashion, you know, generally tends to be quite forward thinking when it comes to adopting new ideas and new tech. You know, and I think the Edit London will naturally be the forefront of that change within our respective market, of course, that being sneaker, streetwear, and collectibles.
Perfect. Well, Moses, thank you so much for your time. It's been great having you.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to the sponsor for this episode, Sourcing at Magic. The Interline will be back in Las Vegas this coming August, 7th through the 9th, to help bring fashion technology to life and to continue to grow the dedicated fashion tech community in North America. So stay tuned for new announcements and new ways to get involved. Whether you're a technology vendor looking to expand your horizons and reach digital decision makers from new and existing audiences, or whether you're a brand owner, designer, or professional who just wants to discover just how much technology can do for you, your colleagues, and your brand. Find out more at www.sourcingatmagic.com. And look for more from the Interline podcast very soon. And be sure to keep an eye on the Interline itself, because we have stories coming up that touch on a lot of the themes we've talked about in this episode.